The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more, and we have a great show for you this week. As always, we're going to talk about TV, one of my favorite things to talk about. In particular, we're going to talk about the recent crossover episode between Abbott Elementary and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Kind of odd bedfellows as TV shows go, but there's a long history of TV crossover episodes, and Paula Schaefer will be here to discuss that history with me and talk about the fun new adventures in crossover TV that we're experiencing. But first, we're going to talk to Stephen Garrett about The Brutalist, which is a 3.5 hour long movie about architecture and residual Holocaust trauma, which doesn't sound like a lot of fun, and it's not a lot of fun, but it is very good. And Stephen and I have many observations about The Brutalist, which is to be a sure contender for Best Picture at the Oscars this year. And Stephen will be here to talk about it with me right after this interlude.
These are yours.
Yes.
Yes.
All of them?
Yes.
Tell me, why is an accomplished foreign architect shoveling coal here in Philadelphia?
I'm afraid it is not so simple.
Promise you won't betray him.
I promise.
I've been waiting a few weeks to see The Brutalist. It opened in New York and Los Angeles, seemingly like 3 years ago, and it finally appeared on one screen, well, one theater in Austin over the weekend, and I went to see it, and I think I'm still at the screening, Stephen.
Oh, I wish I were still at my screening 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of the sixth intermission. The Brutalist, it's a very, very long movie, as long as movies get these days, but it's also an extremely, I guess it's a throwback to classic epics, although not a whole lot happens on screen, but it is an epic. It has a lot of scope. It has a lot of ambition. It's very good. It puts a lot of movies you see to shame. The Brutalist, right?
Yeah, I'm glad you liked it. I was skeptical and a little intimidated when I first read about it and its running time. I thought to myself, oh boy, this is going to be a slog. 3.5 hours with an intermission, blah, blah, blah. And then when I saw it, I was actually, the thing that impressed me the most, I'm curious what you think, but I think the storytelling is actually quite good.
And oh, yes.
It's a really good story. Like, I got sucked in by the story and the characters, which is the best sort of way to get sucked into a movie.
Yeah, and you know, in some ways, the sort of the basic storyline is, I wouldn't say it's simple, but, you know, it is not what I expected. Basically, this Holocaust survivor, Hungarian architect, is hired by a rich Pennsylvania industrialist to build a community center.
Basically, yeah. That's a log line. Yeah, that's it.
And I thought, well, this is the story. I didn't even realize that's all it was. I thought, you know, this architect was gonna be a biopic about how he creates all these great works of architecture all over the country and the world. And that does actually happen. But you don't find out about that until the end. It really focuses very heavily on the construction of this one building and on the relationship between Laszlo Toth, who's the architect, and the industrialist. Oh, I don't remember his name at the moment.
Harrison Van Buren,
played by Guy Pearce, and Laszlo is played by Adrian Brody. truly, I mean, you can't say it's a career-defining performance from Adrian Brody, because, you know, every performance he gives is a career-defining performance, right?
Two-time Holocaust survivor, Adrian Brody, as Nikki Glaser said at the Globes, which I thought was pretty hilarious.
That is, yeah, he was, this was his character from The Pianist with a slightly different accent.
Yeah.
But, you know, as a Jewish person in this age of Jewish people not being the most popular kids in school anymore, I appreciated the respect that the script and the director paid to Holocaust survivors. And it was really good. I thought it was a really good depiction of the trauma that survivors experienced, especially in the early years after the Holocaust. So that was very, very moving.
It's very moving, especially since his wife, who also survived the Holocaust, I think they were separated. He was in, I think, Auschwitz, and she was in Buchenwald, or maybe he was in Dachau, and she was in Buchenwald, right?
Pretty bad places, regardless. Yeah. And then she was repatriated, I believe, to the Soviet Union, and she had to survive the Ukrainian famine as well.
Yeah, so they have been apart for a long time when the movie starts, yeah. And her voice is the first you hear in a letter she's written to him. But the first half of the movie is her absence, and yeah. He's spoken of, she's yearned for, but you don't actually see her until the next act.
The second part.
And I think it's quite moving that the intermission is a photo of them getting married. So they're standing in front of the synagogue where they got married before the war. And it is a plot point in that photo is the proof of their relationship, which allows her to be brought over to the United States with their niece, Sophia, who's also in the photo as well. Erzsébet is her name. Laszlo is his. And everything is so well thought out in this film, even the still photograph on screen during intermission, you know? And it's haunting, and you stare at it, and you watch the countdown of the clock.
Well, I didn't stare at it because I went to the bathroom, but I saw it. Well, yeah, I agree. You know, it's very richly detailed. And after it was over, my wife said, well, she's like, well, what's the real story behind that guy? I'm like, he's not a real guy. Laszlo Toth was not a real guy, and in fact was the name of a Don DeVillo comedy character from the 70s. He wrote these fake letters to President Carter.
Well, he's also famously the man who he's a crazy guy who attacked the Pietà, I think, Michelangelo's Pietà,
right,
and damaged it.
But they chose to give him this name anyway. You know, and the movie, I don't know, like, this guy's got a lot of problems, right? I mean, he's a heroin addict. He has some couple has some weird sexual issues. He has a lot of dysfunctional relationships in his life.
A lot of dysfunctional, but and I think that's what 3.5 hours with an intermission, but every moment to me felt very purposeful and very deliberate and very well thought out. And
yeah,
it is a psychological portrait of a really broken, damaged person who is also incidentally incredibly talented and artistic genius. As they say. I mean, whatever that word means these days. But he certainly is incredibly talented architect of import. And I think also part of the appeal of the main for me, of course, and I think the main appeal of the film is the relationship he has with Harrison Van Buren, who is the industrialist who made his money because, I think it's a throwaway line, but I think it's he figured out a way to move cargo more efficiently during the war. So he's kind of a war profiteer, basically.
So he's essentially...
he's a middleman. You
know, he's a middleman, but he's also essentially, like, the movie makes it very clear, like, he's American, so he's not a Nazi.
Yeah.
No, he's not. But he probably would have been.
Oh, yeah.
given the opportunity. But he's not, you know, he's not really an anti-Semite either. He gives these he has a Jewish lawyer. He gives these Jewish people a shot. He gives them a place to live. He, you know, at least for a while, appears that he values Laszlo's artistic qualities. But, you know, the movie doesn't lack entertainment value. Guy Pearce as Harrison Van Buren is extremely entertaining character.
Yeah, they're all funny. I mean, they're very funny. But what does he say? Like, I find our conversations intellectually stimulating, Laszlo. You know, it's like throws a penny at him and says, oh, that I lost myself. Please hand it back. You're just like, Jesus, this guy.
He really wanted his penny back.
No, but I mean, I think this is very much about Laszlo inspires Harrison. Clearly, part of him reveres Laszlo, part of him envies Laszlo, part of him resents and hates Laszlo. Like, it is a complex emotional reaction and interplay between those two, which I think is really fascinating.
Yeah. I have a question about, it's just very well made. Who is this director? Brady Corbett does not sound like a Jewish name. I could be wrong. Who is this guy?
He's an actor. He pronounces his last name Corbet. The way I used to pronounce David Mamet's name when I was growing up. Ooh, who's this David Mamet?
Like sorbet.
Sorbet.
not sherbet. All right, but who is he,
exactly.
Stephen?
Brady Corbet is started as a child actor. I think he started when he was like 7 or something like that.
Okay.
Came up with a bunch of other actors. One of his colleagues and very close friends is Robert Pattinson, who was in his first movie, Childhood of a Leader, which is about the rise of fascism. It all takes place during, I think, a week when the Treaty of Versailles is hammered out when Wilson visits Paris. It sounds really exciting, right? No, it's like that crossed with The Omen, because you have this devil child who ends up becoming a fascist, you know?
Okay.
And anyway, so that's that movie. Vox Lux is the next movie he made, which is starred Natalie Portman as a pop star who survives as a teenager, is a survivor of a horrific school shooting. And that school shooting affects her music and also her notoriety and fame and popularity and sympathy. And so he's very much somebody who makes movies about how world events and, you know, the historical events have an impact on the individual, and then also how that individual then has an impact on the world because of it and of people around him. So it's very ambitious. You can look at it as part of a series of films that really are studying the human condition and the sociopolitical world over the past, I don't know, the first one took place 100 years ago, the other one took place maybe 20 years ago, and this Brutalist takes place mid-century. So they're all period pieces, which I think is kind of ambitious. But anyway, just to very quickly, Phil, before he started making the films, he was an actor, but he worked mostly in Europe. So he was in a Lars von Trier movie. He was in a Michael Haneke movie. He was in a Bertrand Bonello movie. So he's worked with a lot of European kind of auteurs, so to speak. So he's been around. He's a familiar face. He's been around a while as an actor. For a certain select group of art house moviegoers, they'll say, oh, Brady Corbet. Yeah, I kind of know him.
Well, this is kind of the Brutalist is an art house movie through and through, but it also is one of those art house movies that has a little bit of mainstream breakthrough.
Kind of does, amazingly. Yeah.
Kind of. I mean, it's still not going to be a massive hit, but it could potentially win Best Picture. It has Best Picture written all over it. It's got the big themes, it's got the scope. It's a work of real visual beauty and quality. And I also I wanted to point out, too, that it's part of a trend that I'm seeing of works that are taking Jewish culture and identity seriously. In the theater, there was that the movie with Jason Schwartzman and Carol Kane, Between the Temples.
Oh, Between the Temples, yeah.
Yeah, which is obviously, like, the scope was much smaller than this. And then...
And very much a comedy, overtly.
Right, as was A Real Pain, Jesse Eisenberg's movie. We've talked about both those films on the podcast before. The Brutalist is, it's Raging Bull compared to those films. it's much bigger and broader and better. But it pays... the same respect to Jews and to Judaism, which, you know, as a Jewish person, I appreciate.
Yeah. And I think it's also really, this is one thing that shows up early and often, is that Laszlo Toth encounters people either in his family, kin, or strangers or acquaintances, and sees how Jewish people are either folded into the American society or they're kind of rejected I'm making too much of it. I was amazed at his cousin, who's the first person he sees. Alessandro Nivola plays him in Attila.
His cousin Attila, and, yeah.
Yeah, who has changed his name, married a Shiksa.
And converted to Catholicism.
And he's like, yeah, well, whatever. I tell people, and he has a business called Miller and Sons, and Laszlo Toth is like, Sons? And he's like, yeah, I made it up because that's what people want to see. He's like, I am assimilating hell or high water. I am rejecting my past and my Judaism, you know, as soon as I can. And Laszlo Toth is absolutely, is clearly repulsed.
He's appalled by that. Because he does the opposite. He does the opposite. He, in fact, he secretly builds a better version of a concentration camp.
Spoiler.
I know, right? But whatever. Spoiler. Disguising it as a community center. And like, and there's lots of scenes of him, you know, going to temple. His wife, you know, his wife is, there's a lot of talk of Israel. His wife is very proudly Jewish. Well,
if the founding of the Jewish state happens during the movie, yes. and Sophia, his niece, basically emigrates over to Israel and becomes Israeli, and then brings Erzsébet over there eventually, right?
Right. So that is happening as well. So there's that subtext, and it's also just a, you know, a movie that pays homage to a certain kind of ambitious architecture that we have lost. So
it's very much a movie about integrity, isn't it? I mean, creative integrity, architectural integrity, religious integrity, you know, political integrity. Yeah. And it's so many examples in this film of people compromising their integrity time and time again, mainly for money.
I wouldn't know anything about that, Stephen.
I know, right? You and me both. But Laszlo Toth is the obstinate, person who will not give up his integrity.
As long as he can get some heroin.
As he can get on the horse, exactly, and go to a jazz club and hang out with his black friends. You know, it's a little on the nose about that kind of stuff. But yeah, I thought it was so surprising and fascinating in ways I was not expected when I sat down to watch it.
Agreed. Great film. One of the best of the year. A surefire contender, if not the odds-on favorite, to win the Oscar for Best Picture. The Brutalist may be playing somewhere within 100 miles of you, I don't know how far you'd go out of your. I mean, we drove like 15 miles to go see it.
Can I quickly interject? Some theaters are showing it in 70 millimeter. It was shot in VistaVision, which is an old technology that they've kind of revived. It has big cameras, and the main reason because they wanted to capture the vista of the vision, right?
Yeah. Well, no, because the VistaVision is shot horizontally. It's fed through the camera horizontally as opposed to vertically, and so it creates it literally creates a vista. And I actually P.T. Anderson is making his next movie in using VistaVision as well. So we're having a little VistaVision revival. And
yeah, after about 60 years of no one using VistaVision. And I think you bring up Anderson. I think there is very much in The Brutalist, there's a DNA of like movies like There Will Be Blood. You know,
I was thinking that too. There Will Be Blood and Phantom Thread to some extent as well.
Yeah.
Movies that are like, you know, on the surface, you're like, I'm not going to watch that. And then as soon as it starts, you're like, oh, I'm not going to stop watching that because movies are really gripping and weird and kind of being even kinky in their own way. Yeah. There's a lot of, we're going to cut this short, but you know, there's also, let's be clear, there's some kinky sex in this movie.
Yeah, gripping and weird and kinky, I think, is the pull quote for this poster for The Brutalist. Yeah.
All right, The Brutalist is in theaters now. See it in VistaVision if you can. You got to block off a whole afternoon, but it's worth it. Stephen, thank you so much. Continue to have integrity, if at all possible.
You too, though.
One of the most surprising pop culture developments of the year so far was the crossover episode between It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and Abbott Elementary, two TV shows that do take place in Philadelphia, but really couldn't be more different temperamentally, and it got me to thinking about the history of TV crossover episodes, because I've wasted pretty much 50 years of my life watching television, and I was talking to Paula Schaefer, one of our writers, about this, and we decided that it'd be good for her to write an article about it, because she also watches a lot of TV, and Paula is here today to talk with me about TV crossover episodes. Hello, Paula. Welcome back.
Yeah, it's great to talk about TV crossover episodes.
Yeah, so your piece was a lot of fun. Well, first of all, let's talk about the main one, the one that is in the news. I don't know if it's really in the news, but it's in the entertainment news right now. The It's Always Sunny
and Abbott Elementary crossover, which I personally found, they've only aired the Abbott Elementary part of it, though It's Always Sunny version of it will be later this year, but I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I watched it. I'm not an It's Always Sunny fan because they're a little shouty for me, but I watched it and I thought that it did not like veer from either show's characters too far. It was in its, the context of the world, it was believable.
Yeah, I mean, the It's Always Sunny, it was a little more PG than It's Always Sunny is, because it's Abbott Elementary, which is like the most wholesome show ever. But the characters were mostly in it, although Glenn Howerton's character kind of hid from the camera, which was one of the running gags. But they behaved as they do on the show. It wasn't like they, you know, if Danny DeVito eating weird things and Charlie Day being stupid and Sweet D being, you know, a bizarre, jealous, sexual predator. Yeah. None of these, nothing really changed.
Yeah, they found a way to work, make it work.
Yeah, so I thought it was funny, and I loved Abbott Elementary the first season. Then by the second season, I kind of got tired of its kind of gee whiz take on things. It felt a little forced to me, and it felt like it was like a lot of shows happen when it happens when they get successful. It was a little high on its own supply, but I've always loved It's Always Sunny. It just always makes me laugh. It's just so absurd and so over the top, and you know, and it's run for 17 seasons.
I know, that's a lot of seasons
for a live action TV show.
Yes,
it's like almost absolutely as long as Gunsmoke. It's ridiculous. Yep,
it is the Gunsmoke of our time.
It is. I mean, that's a lot. That's so much TV. There's just so many episodes, and the seasons are long. Anyway, so I thought it was very successful, but you know, you pointed out. You know, when I was thinking about TV crossover episodes, the one that came to mind because I'm old was when three doctors from St. Elsewhere went to Cheers in 1985. I was like, well, St. Elsewhere and Cheers. Like that was the first thing. Like no one even remembers that anymore. But I loved both those shows. So that was a great, great moment for me. And I went back and watched the scene and it was okay. It felt like watching an old like listening to like a 1930s radio drama.
What I learned actually from your obsession with the Cheers Scene Elsewhere thing is there is actually an entire Tommy Westfall universe. And like that people have this, you know, you said nobody cares about it anymore, but there's this whole online community that's very active in the 500 shows that they all think stem from the snow globe in St. Elsewhere.
Yeah, the snow globe ending, which proved that the entire series was a hallucination in the mind of an autistic boy.
Yep.
Which is, you know, it was a lot. That was a lot to swallow. So that means that Cheers would never existed.
Correct.
Which means that Frasier never existed. And so on and so forth.
Exactly.
It's all in the mind of Tommy Westfall, who by now is, you know, a 65-year-old man living in a home somewhere. All right. But those aren't the only shows that ever crossed over. You mentioned some that I wasn't familiar with. Like, I loved the Abed from Community on Cougar Town.
Yeah, it was a whole thing. Like, Abed had a storyline where he kind of mentioned his love of Cougar Town and he told everybody he won a Facebook contest to go be an extra on Cougar Town. And then a Cougar Town episode threw him in the background. And on Community, he said he pooped his pants because he was so excited. And if you watch the Cougar Town episode, he's got a weird look on his face. And you know what he's doing if you saw the other show.
So that what I love is that those shows were on different networks. And yep, they had to kind of, you know, Cougar Town was kind of more short-lived. Maybe it wasn't. I don't know, but they were equal levels of success. Yeah, Community was more hip, but you know, and the reason they put Cougar Town in there was because, you know, I think that Dan Harmon would probably consider Cougar Town a lesser TV show than Community, but the show was cool enough to incorporate that. So I like that, and I also you hearkened back to the golden era of Will Smith and The Fresh Prince.
Yes. Who could forget George Jefferson on The Fresh Prince? Maybe everybody except me, but
I mean, I watched The Jeffersons back in the day. I never watched The Fresh Prince because it was the 90s, and I was the only TV show I watched in the 90s was Seinfeld. So that show needed no crossovers, but but I watched that scene and that it was funny. And then I love the detail about how the Jeffersons bought the mansion in Bel Air.
Yep. I guess they don't need their deluxe apartment in the sky anymore when they are moving.
Did they actually show them doing it, or did they just mention it?
I think it's just kind of like a mentioned, or like they show up because they're the new buyers.
And they outbid Mr. Drummond from Different Strokes. And then the other one you mentioned was when the Supernatural, Sam and Dean Winchester from Supernatural, there's an episode where they become animated and they go into Scooby-Doo.
Yes, it's Scooby Natural among the fans. There's some monster haunting whatever, and Dean ends up sucked into the world of Scooby-Doo, and you know, he gets an ascot like Freddy's, and they all join forces and solve the mystery of whatever's going on.
I mean, this is all just so TV, right? Like you could really, like, the Community and Cougar Town thing shows you know, TV exists in its own reality. So you could technically have any character from any show appear on any other show at any time.
Pretty much.
I'm trying to think when did that trend start? You pointed out that, you know, the ones that we remember most is when they used to use Happy Days to launch other shows, right?
Yes, that was very confusing for me as a child watching the reruns of all of those shows because they all took place in different decades, but they were all made in a different decade than that. And then I was watching them in a different decade from the, like, it really messed with my sense of the time-space continuum when I was little.
Well, yeah, and it really messed with this time-space continuum in Happy Days, which was originally conceived of as kind of like an American Graffiti-like nostalgia show about the 50s, then introduced a space alien.
Yes, exactly.
the ultimate shark jump, introducing, but also gave us Robin Williams. But using that as a launching point for Mork and Mindy, that's just extremely bizarre. Speaking of ABC in that era, you did not mention one of my favorite crossovers of all time, which was when on two consecutive hours of the same show, the same Lonnie Anderson character was on the Love Boat, where she did not find love, and then went to Fantasy Island.
Oh my gosh! No,
where she memorably became a brown-haired version of Lonnie Anderson, which is what a lot of young men wished for back in that day.
So it was a true Fantasy Island episode.
Yeah, it's like Lonnie. Let's make Lonnie Anderson a kind of a nerdy brunette. I'm like, yes, please. Give me more. But you know, and I even remember like at the end of the episode, they're like, oh, I hear so-and-so is going to Fantasy Island.
Oh, wow. Of course.
That blew my mind. I love, as someone who loves TV and has always loved TV, like the crossover is so appealing, right?
It is, because it's kind of like a wish fulfillment. Oh, man, I wish this person could meet this person. And sometimes it happens.
Yeah, so that, you know, and it makes you think, like, why didn't Steve Carell ever go on to Parks and Recreation as Michael Scott, right?
That would have been harder, though, since Rashida Jones was on both shows as different people.
Oh, that's true. They could have made a joke out of it, but yes, I'm just saying, like, there seemed to, you know, I kept it, like, I love crossovers so much that I kept expecting, when I went to see A Complete Unknown, the movie in the theater, I kept expecting, like, you know, Peggy Olson to show up in the audience or something, you know, or Don Draper to be
Don Draper shows up
to be in the back of one of those nightclubs, like rolling his eyes, going to these freaking beatniks, you know. It's what I want. It's all you want, really, out of when you're a pop culture fan, is to see characters from things appearing in other things.
There's actually an entire archive that some private citizen has compiled that I found. Called poobala.com.
Okay.
poobala.com. It hasn't been updated for 5 years, but it's this giant comprehensive networking of every show crossover or times one show mentions another. And he has it categorized like spinoff, crossover, shared reality.
Are there any good ones from your article that you didn't put in your article that we've missed here?
I mean, there are so many. There are so many. it's hard to say. Well, that's what was hard about writing this piece, because it was hard to just pick a couple to focus on. Like what I didn't talk about because it would have been a whole sidetrack, is when Angel left Buffy, and then they would air episodes because they were both on, I think it was still the WB at that time. and they would air an episode where something on Buffy would happen, and then Angel would find out about it in the next episode, or Buffy would go visit Angel, or then Angel would come to Sunnydale to see Buffy. And they did some amount of back and forth to kind of keep those worlds connected for a while until the show switched networks. And that's like my favorite when that happens. And I always...
Yeah, well I'm sure you were a big fan of the Buffyverse, so...
Yes, yes.
Well, and here's, and I had something like that happen to me recently. I was watching TV. I don't know if you're a fan of the Philomena Kunk specials.
On, oh, yes, yeah. Of course.
So, I don't know if you saw the new one, Kunk on Life.
Not yet.
Okay. Well, there is a moment, and this spoils nothing because basically, like, it's just gag after gag after gag. But there's a moment in the show where Philomena Kunk goes to visit the headquarters of Streamberry. And Streamberry is, if you're a fan of Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror, is the fake Netflix streaming service that they use on the Annie Murphy episode where she basically is like wakes up and sees her life being played out on Streamberry on a daily basis, and there's a whole multiple layers artificial intelligence alternate realities thing going on in that episode. But when Philomena Kunk goes to visit Streamberry, I'm like, oh, Philomena Kunk is part of the Black Mirror universe.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, not only does it makes sense, and it also makes sense because it's the same guy created both the shows. But it's like, yeah, but that's a crossover. That's how it's done. It's like an Easter egg for people who actually give a crap about these sorts of things. So that, and the Abbott It's Always Sunny crossover, those are, I would say, all of those are shows for relatively intelligent viewers, right?
Yeah.
To me, it's a sign of the endlessly universal appeal of this stuff.
Yeah, I agree.
So maybe we can have like a crossover episode of the podcast. I don't know. What would that involve? Like maybe someone from another podcast could be on this podcast. We've already done that. So, again, we've had crossovers before. Life is a crossover. Let's face it. Eventually you cross over.
That is true. Life's a crossover till you cross over.
All right. Thank you so much, Paula Schaefer. Her piece on crossovers is up now. And her another piece that she wrote, which I thought was great as well, about the rise of the tromcom, sort of sitcoms that are actually kind of sad. is also up. We did not talk about that, but I recommend that you read those both. It's great to have Paula back writing for about TV for us, and we will talk to you soon. All right, thank you so much, Paula Schaefer. The Abbott Elementary episode featuring the gang from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is now available to stream on Hulu, and the It's Always Sunny episode that will go along with that should be out later this year and will also be available to stream on FX and Hulu. And also thanks to Stephen Garrett for talking to me about The Brutalist, which is not available to stream on Hulu. It is currently being rolled out in movie theaters across the country very, very slowly. It's amazing that they're able to get an enthusiastic audience for a movie about things that are this heavy and are this intellectual, but it gives me hope that people are still interested in seeing things like that. I am Neil Pollack. I am the host of this show. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, a product of Sea of Reeds Media. You can also visit our independent bookstores in New Jersey, the Bookhouse in Millburn, and the Bookhouse in Long Branch. Please patronize your local independent bookstores. Please watch your television, and please go to the movies. It's always good to stimulate your brain. Or to rot your brain. It doesn't really matter. I don't actually care what you do, but I do care that you're listening to the show, and I thank you, and I will talk to you soon. Audio
Original Production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.